FM News 101.
Quiet, please.
Ladies and gentlemen.
You ready for the big show?
You're ready.
In exactly 15 seconds, we'll be on the air.
Lars. This is the Lars Larson Show.
With great humility, I am asking you to be excited.
Honestly provocative talk with Lars Larson.
I may be a white boy, but I'm not stupid.
Broadcasting across the Pacific Northwest and covering Oregon, Washington, and Idaho on the Radio Northwest Network.
Lars.
And now.
And then we're going to kick the Biden crime family out of the White House.
Here's your host.
My memory is so bad, I let you speak.
Lars Larson.
Because if she becomes president, our country is going to be a giant fail. It's going to fail. It's going to be a failure the likes of which this world has never seen.
That's right. That's President Donald Trump. And he's actually talking to reporters, something that Kamala Harris is not doing these days, has not done for more than 2 weeks. And we want to talk about that and the big news about debates, because while Kamala Harris has not agreed to a single presidential debate, I mean, imagine this. Somebody who got to be the nominee of the Democrat Party without any democracy. No votes need be cast to pick Kamala Harris as the presidential nominee of the Democrat Party. And then she stops talking to the press. It's now been 2.5 weeks since she did an interview, since she did a press conference. And Donald Trump does not shy away from talking to reporters. He did that today. He answered questions unscripted from reporters, something that even Joe Biden was not willing to do, and something that apparently Kamala Harris is not willing to do. And we all know why. Because every time she shows up in front of a microphone or a camera, she embarrasses herself. And she understands that her presidential ambitions could be over just about as fast as Joe Biden's presidential ambitions ended after that colossal disaster of a debate just a couple of months ago. Welcome to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you on Conspiracy Theory Thursday. And I'm always glad to take your calls. I don't hide from anybody like Kamala Harris does. If you want to jump in to what we call the best conversation in talk journalism, it's right here every day at 866-HEY-LARS. And if you're a naysayer, we're going to put you right to the head of the line. If you've got the guts, you'll get a chance to make your point. And then you have to give me a chance to ask a few questions of you. If you want to send me an email instead, that's easy. talk@LarsLarson.com. And vote in our X poll. And this advances some of the news I'm about to tell you. Should America see 3 presidential debates as Donald Trump proposes and 3 networks have agreed to air, or no debates because Kamala Harris hasn't agreed to any of them? Should America at least get a chance to see Kamala Harris tested in the same way that Joe Biden was tested? Or is Kamala Harris afraid that if she were tested, why, it would be all over for her as well? Anyway, welcome to the Lars Larson Show. The biggest news, as I just told you, to come out of Donald Trump's press conference today is about presidential debates. And if you say, well, does that mean we're going to see some presidential debates? Well, as of now, Kamala Harris, the no voters needed nominee of the Democrat Party, has not agreed to one single debate. Donald Trump, on the other hand, wants a trio of debates in the month of September.
We think we should do 3 debates. We think Fox and ABC, and we also have CBS is going to do the vice presidential debate. So CBS will do vice presidential, and I have to tell you, J.D. Vance has really stepped up. He's doing a fantastic job.
Can you imagine a vice presidential debate between U.S. Marine Corps veteran J.D. Vance and, of course, Tim Walz from Minnesota, who famously and shamefully lied about and continues to lie about his own military record? So the 4 debate dates, September 4 with Fox, September 10 with NBC, September 25 with ABC. And as I'll remind you, at this point, Kamala Harris has not agreed to any debates at all. And she's been out campaigning, but she's been ducking any questions from reporters who've been following her around. In fact, it's reported today she has only answered off-the-record questions from the press aboard Air Force Two. Now, I've been the party to off-the-record questioning, but usually it's so you can get background and understand the situation. At some point, though, she's got to go on the record. Harris reportedly spoke with reporters off the record for 4 minutes on Tuesday and for 5 minutes yesterday. Now, consider that. She's talked to the press a grand total of 9 minutes and only off the record. The way Trump summed it up, Harris is just not smart enough to do a news conference. And I think to some extent, if you take a listen to her sound bites, and she is God's gift to talk radio, because every single day that she's in front of a camera or a mic, she produces crazy stuff that I get a chance to do. Now, or use on the show. Now, is that good for America? No, it's not. So vice presidential candidate Senator J.D. Vance, and I told you this yesterday, he found a very bold way to point out when his campaign plane landed in Wisconsin at the same airport in Eau Claire, about the same time that Kamala Harris's Air Force Two touched down, and he walked over and teased reporters who were waiting for her about the fact that Kamala Harris won't talk to reporters and has not for 18 days and counting. Meanwhile, lame duck President Joe Biden did sit down for an interview with CBS News, and he said something absolutely extraordinary, predicting trouble if Donald Trump is chosen by American voters.
Are you confident that there will be a peaceful transfer of power in January 2025?
If Trump wins, no, I'm not confident at all. I mean, if Trump loses, I'm not confident at all. He means what he says. We don't take him seriously. He means it. All the stuff about if we lose, there'll be a bloodbath.
That's not what Donald Trump said, but let's stick to the facts, Joe. President Trump did use the term bloodbath when he said what would happen if Joe Biden won and allowed the Chinese communists to start importing electric cars to America, that there would be a bloodbath in the U.S. auto industry. And I think he's absolutely right about that. And Joe Biden tries to morph it into, he says if he loses, there's going to be a bloodbath. But I think, honestly, that what Joe Biden did in that soundbite, and I'll play it again if you like, he committed what they call in Washington, D.C., a gaffe. And a gaffe in Washington, D.C. is when a politician accidentally tells the truth. By the way, I point this out. I'll get to Jamie Raskin here in just a moment. But Trump today even seemed a little bit sympathetic to the plight of slow Joe Biden, who was kicked to the curb by his own party, which then chose a replacement without even bothering to ask Democrat voters.
And I'm no Biden fan, but I tell you what, from a constitutional standpoint, from any standpoint you look at, they took the presidency away. And people were saying he lost after the debate. He couldn't win. Well, I don't know that that's true necessarily. But whether he could win or he couldn't win, he had the right to run. And they took it away. They said they're going to use the 25th Amendment. They're going to hit you hard. Either we can do it the nice. I heard. I know exactly because I know a lot of people on the other side, believe it or not. And they said we'll do it the nice way. We'll do it the hard way.
And Joe gave in. Democrats seem resigned to Trump's win in November, with the top Democrat member in Congress, Jamie Raskin, saying out loud that in January of next year, he and other Democrats plan to use the 14th Amendment to the Constitution to block President Trump from taking office, as though Raskin is already expecting Trump will win and then they'll block him.
So it's going to be up to us on January 6, 2025 to tell the rampaging Trump mobs that he's disqualified. And then we need bodyguards for everybody in civil war conditions.
Now, understand what he's talking about. Section 3 of the 14th Amendment was written to prohibit people who'd taken part as active combatants in the Civil War against the North from running for office. That does not apply to Donald Trump. And for those of you who say, but he engaged in insurrection, he was never charged with insurrection, and neither were any other people. Glad to be with you. Always glad to take your calls. 866-HEY-LARS. You've got the Lars Larson Show and the Radio Northwest Network.
Before you are, weeding out the right from the wrong. This is the Lars Larson Show.
That makes a lot of sense. A lot of nonsense.
Right, you're bloody well right. You know you got a right to say.
This is the Northwest Nonsense.
How much longer do we have to sit for this nonsense?
That great moment every day where Lars brings you the cold, hard facts without any liberal wokeness from the Daily Dead fish wrapper or mainstream media bias.
Hey, folks, let's just be honest about this. You know how it is when you spend other people's money. You spend it on the fun stuff. Portlandia cut an already understaffed police bureau 4 years ago because that's what the mob in the street demanded. Defund the police. This year's budget didn't even see an increase in police budgets big enough to compensate for Bidenomics inflation. Still, the city clearly has some dough to blow. It bought the aging Moda Center for $7 million. Now, you might wonder, Paul Allen spent $250 million about a third of a century ago to build that place. It's got to be worth more than $7 million. Only it's kind of a trick deal. Lame duck mayor Feckless Ted Wheeler has agreed to go halves on the cost of renovating the building with no idea of what that price tag is going to be. So see if you can wrap your head around that idea. Do you know what the Blazers just did? They got $7 million cash. And you know what the city of Portland got? They got half the renovation bill for whatever that's going to cost. I mean, it could literally easily be tens of millions of dollars. I mean, that sounds like a great deal. The Portland Trailblazers then generously agreed to stick around for at least 5 years. But after that, the city could end up owning a big empty box with no big tenant. Now, if you don't think that's possible, just take a look at Memorial Coliseum right next door. And then the Blazers dangled a 20-year deal to stay in the city after that, but I'm betting it all depends on how sweet the city makes the deal. Meanwhile, City Commissioner Rene Gonzalez, who just might become the next mayor of Portland, spent thousands of taxpayer dollars, I kid you not, polishing up his Wikipedia page. Taxpayer money to polish up his personal Wikipedia page right in the middle of a political campaign. You know, when you're spending other people's money, no expense is too great or too crazy. Glad to get to your calls in a moment at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277, with naysayers always going to the head of the line. If you want to send me an email, it's talk@LarsLarson.com. And by the way, our poll on X, because we come up with a brand new poll question every day, and based on what Donald Trump's just talked about, he has negotiated for three different presidential debates with Kamala Harris. Kamala Harris has agreed to no presidential debates at this point, and she's dodged the press for about 18 days and counting. Does anybody actually expect that she's going to stand up and start taking questions from reporters? Or is she going to run the same kind of stealth campaign that Joe Biden ran back in 2020 without the excuse of old age, infirmity, or a pandemic? Should America see three presidential debates, as Donald Trump proposes, or the none that Kamala Harris has agreed to? I would say we need to see three presidential debates. We need to see Kamala Harris actually stand up and take questions from moderators, challenges from her competition. And if she holds up well, then maybe the voters will decide to vote for her. If she doesn't, which I suspect is what's going to happen, and I think she knows that too. I mean, she has become that person who has risen to a point she was never prepared for. She was the affirmative action hire of Joe Biden, who chose her not based on her skills and abilities, as we've seen for the last 3.5 years, but based on her gender and her skin color. Today's X poll: should America see three presidential debates, as Donald Trump proposes, or the none that Kamala Harris has agreed to? Ultimate Truck Services brings you the X Bowl. If you rely on trucks for business, Ultimate keeps your biggest assets on the road and running right. Find them at ultimatetruckservice.com. Now, a couple of other things I want to mention. Our question of the day comes in unsigned, but it says, would a CEO be fired for running a schedule like Joe Biden's? His schedule this week is truly absurd. One phone call on the schedule for Monday. Nothing on Tuesday or Wednesday, one phone call and a ceremony today, and then off to the beach house for a long weekend. Any employer CEO who did that, Lars, would be fired. Biden is the leader of the free world, and he's turning in 10 hours of work every week. And now to the Daily Grill.
Insane.
Are you completely insane?
Ridiculous.
ridiculous.
They get more and more ridiculous.
Flat out dumb.
You're even dumber than I thought.
Who deserves today's Lars Grill of the Day?
Maybe they're just really, really stupid.
Find out right now.
I want to give today's Daily Grill to the city of Portlandia for saddling taxpayers with a multi-million dollar obligation in the MODIS Center. They didn't get something, they got an obligation, and getting nothing but the bill and a five-year promise from the Portland Trailblazers. Our best email of the day, but you can always send more, comes from Scott Pine. Lars, I think the Democrats are so confident in winning because they have all their people in place to rig the election the way they did in 2020. And if that does happen, they're going to shut it down, where they'll be the only ones to oversee the counting, even if there is a recount. This is what worries me most. But if the Trump-Vance ticket does win, the Democrats again have all their people in place to create havoc, just like they did in 2016. My vote will count, but will it really matter? We'll only have to wait and see in November, signed Scott Pine. Send those emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. And let me jump quickly to Britt. Hey, Britt, welcome to the Lars Larson Show. What's on your mind?
Yes, Lars. Do we have the legal right to elections integrity?
Yes. We have the right to it. I don't have the expectation, but I have. But we have the right. Sure. It's a question that answers itself.
I wasted 10 years of my life running for public office because the law didn't provide for elections integrity. Do you think something like that's going to play out in the future?
It probably will, because in the states of Oregon and Washington, the only people with the capability to change the system are the people who are elected. And if you can control who gets elected and you make sure that nobody gets elected who ever wants to change the election system, they have done at the local level what the Biden crime family has been trying to do at the federal level. And that is, once you have the reins of power, use the reins of power, the FBI, the CIA, the DOJ, the courts, and everything else to maintain that power, whether the voters chose you or not. Britt, thanks for the call. And this is one suggestion for change, although I think that Jim Walsh is being a little bit timid. One day, this is Como News, one day after Washington's primary election, and I voted in that, a familiar refrain from the state's GOP, bring back in-person voting. The chair of the Washington State Republican Party, that's Jim Walsh, put out a call on social media to ditch the state's vote-by-mail process. I would also ditch the jungle primary, and I'd go back to party primaries. He said, we'd like the focus of our elections in Washington state to be in-person, same-day voting, but we believe that is the most transparent, most confidence-inspiring, and in many ways, most reliable way to run an election. I agree with him wholeheartedly. Do you know why King County says they don't want to do it? They claim that mail voting is cheaper. Now, when it comes to elections, do you care about cheap and easy or getting solid results? Because all King County says when they're asked about that idea, well, we're running polling places. We have to secure 500 places just in King County and hire 8,000 people to go out and staff those polling locations. So King County is saying it's cheap, it's easy, and it produces a predictable result for the Democrat Party. That's essentially what they're saying. Glad to be with you on a Conspiracy Theory Thursday. If you want to join the best conversation, it's 866-HEY-LARS. Coming up in a moment, I want to talk about the wildfire hazard maps that are produced by states, and is there any good reason to spend all that money when they're not used by the insurance companies? Not one little bit. We'll get to that next.
The Lars Larson Show. Whenever you want it. Get the podcasts all day, every day at LarsLarson.com.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you, and I've complained loudly and long for literally decades about the wildfire problem in the Pacific Northwest. I point out that, you know, for a period of time, about 35 years or so, the Northwest had no major fires at all. Now, we have about 500,000 acres in Oregon and 500,000 in Washington burn every single year. On bad years, we go above 1 million acres in Washington and sometimes above 1 million in Washington state. I should have said Oregon. So both states now see massive amounts of wildfires. So an Oregon wildfire hazard map, you might say, well, that's a good idea. Except the question is, how does it get used? Kenton Brine is the president of the Northwest Insurance Council. Kenton, welcome to the program, I think, for the first time. How are you? Kenton, are you there? Oh, shoot. I'll tell you what. Joel, will you check his line and make sure we've got him? But the bottom line is I get lots and lots of emails from people who say, you know, the state of Oregon has come out with this wildfire hazard map, and it's going to screw up my insurance to the point where it's going to raise my rates and maybe even leave me uninsured if you happen to live in a rural part of the state in the area of wildfire. And yet, that's not the case. Number one, the insurance companies don't use the state's map. Kenton, welcome to the program, sir.
Thank you very much for having me.
Let's start with that question right off the bat. When the state of Oregon or any state produces a wildfire hazard map, do the insurance companies use it to set their rates?
Typically, no, and definitely not in the state of Oregon. There's no history of insurance companies using a state-produced wildfire map for insurance underwriting, where we decide whether or not to insure a property, or rating, which is how much an insurer charges a property owner.
I was just telling people that I get lots of emails from people saying the state of Oregon is making me become uninsured because they produce this wildfire map and it's inaccurate. And explain the reason why different insurance companies will develop their own maps and their own assessment of whether or not a place is a risky place to have a house.
Sure. Well, the state wildfire map is kind of a different product. It's intended to determine where they might need to place resources or where there's a higher level of wildfire risk that might require homeowners to do some mitigation, not just for insurance, for, you know, reasons that might relate to their own property or their insurance, but also the risk that they would, their house burning would catch their neighbor's house on fire. Insurance companies look at that sort of information as well, but they have developed, in typically much more highly sophisticated maps that take into consideration the history of fire in the area, the topography, the slope, the kind of fuel load there is on the property, how long it's been since there's been a fire. But they're also looking at it for insurability reasons. So they're going to look at the, you know, what is the siding on the house? What is the roofing material made of on the house? What is the, is there defensible space built around the house and that sort of thing in a more detailed way, because they're looking at it, determine what the risk level is, whether they can insure that property and keep their promises to all the people they write insurance for, and how much they need to charge for that property if they're going to insure.
Now, because the insurance business needs state insurance sign off, and you got to stay, relatively friendly with the legislature, are you open to telling me, so does that mean the state of Oregon's wildfire hazard map is not nearly as accurate as what the private sector has?
I don't think I could accurately characterize it that way, simply because I don't know all the details and information that goes into the state map. I know that it's not suitable for insurance purposes, and that's why we've never used it. And now, of course, there's a law that's been passed that says we can't ever use a state-produced wildfire map. That was in Senate Bill 82 that was enacted last session, 2023.
So they prohibited you from doing something you don't do anyway.
That is correct.
Okay.
And I think that they did it because they wanted to make the point. I mean, legislators definitely didn't want, they also, I guess, were skeptical as to whether insurers have used the map, because insurers do use their own maps, and it does often result in people either having their insurance non-renewed for a new policy term or having their rates go up significantly. But that's kind of a separate problem that has to do with the problems that insurance companies are finding with widespread wildfire losses.
Well, the other thing is, I imagine you spend a lot of money doing all these proprietary, you know, studies to get proprietary information on which you base your rates, because then when insurance companies, and you're representing the industry, you're not from a particular company, but those companies want to compete. And if they say, well, we've got this person here and everybody else has rated them out, we're going to rate them in and we think they're still a good property to insure. That's how competition drives down the price and provides good service to customers. Am I right?
That is really well said. I mean, there is, I know that the market is tighter than it has been in years, and that homeowners are struggling in parts of Oregon because of wildfire risk, and insurers are tightening down on their underwriting, and that's why insurer policyholders are struggling a bit to find coverage in some cases. But there is still a robust competitive market, and every insurer has its own, you know, ingredients going in the soup of who they want to insure and how they can compete in the marketplace with each other in order to offer as much insurance to as many people as they can afford to insure.
I guess even though the insurance companies are not going to share their proprietary information with the state, because then they'd be sharing with their competition as well, would there be any way for the insurance industry to get together and say to the state, by the way, if you'd make these changes throughout the state, you know, cut this forest, replant this, station equipment in different spots, could the insurance industry actually help the state become more resilient against wildfire by sharing some, but not, you know, not the proprietary stuff?
I think that some of that is already happening. I mean, some of it occurs sort of naturally because if insurers are sort of not writing as much coverage or non-renewing policies in a certain area, it becomes pretty obvious that that's a higher wildfire risk area. But also insurers are working as best we can with legislators and policymakers and the Department of Forestry and all the other entities, State Fire Marshal's Office, all in an effort to identify together where these high-risk properties are and working on ways to encourage mitigation in those spaces so that people can, one, continue to get insurance, but two, protect their own homes and their neighbors' homes in the case of a large-scale wildfire, which, of course, we've seen about 40 of those around Oregon so far this year.
See, I kind of suspect somebody among the insurance companies knows, you know, the state could, you know, drastically improve the situation if they just do this, this, and this. And I kind of wish the insurance industry would come out and share that with the public, saying, hey, you're worried about fire insurance being too expensive, especially in wildfire areas. Have your state change these things, and it'll go down dramatically. Except, I don't know if it's politic for you to do that when you're a state-regulated industry.
Well, it is tricky, and I think the problem for insurers is, insurers are working together and with, you know, science-based research organizations like the Insurance Institute for Business and Home Safety. They've developed a program called Wildfire Prepared Home. It's the most comprehensive and insurance industry-supported standard for making your home a much lower risk of a total loss in case of a wildfire. That program is rolling out as a sort of pilot project in places like California and Colorado. It hasn't yet come to Oregon, but people can access it and they can learn about ways to build defensible space. It doesn't mean you have to have a new roof, although if you have a shake roof, you should be considering it.
You're kind of asking fire at that point, aren't you?
Yeah, kind of. But, simple things like not having a wood fence that leads up to your house. It's like a fuse. Not stacking firewood outside, right, immediately up against your siding. Have defensible space where you don't have trees and shrubs up right up against your house. You know, if you have a wood deck, treat it so that it's less fire resistant. If you're building a deck, don't use wood. Use a fire resistant material.
Is one of the suggestions, if your state does not do good management of its forests, find a new state or elect different people to the state legislature? I guess that probably wouldn't be right to put that on the list either. That's Kenton Brine. Kenton, thank you very much. Kenton Brine is the president of the Northwest Insurance Council. And by the way, other than paying for fire insurance on my house, I got no dog in the fight on this one. Your phone calls and emails coming up on a Conspiracy Theory Thursday. You're listening to the Lars Larson Show.
Snowflakes, yes, you are probably going to be offended. This is the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It appears that just like that, Donald Trump challenges Kamala Harris to three debates, and she has now agreed to one on September 10th. No word yet on whether or not she's going to have the guts to show up for the other two that Donald Trump has proposed and that the networks have agreed to air. To your calls, it's great to be with you on the Radio Northwest Network. If you want to weigh in, it's 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. And by the way, I'm told there's a 4-alarm brush fire going on in Cherry Grove, which is a small town about due east of Tillamook and somewhat west and south of Forest Grove. If you've got eyes on that fire right now, call me up at 866-439-5277. Let me go first to, let's go to David. Hey, David, welcome to the program. What's on your mind?
Hi, Lars. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I was just calling in regards to some information was left out in regards to how your home or your insurance policy is rated when you want to take out a new application and open up.
Okay, what did we leave out, Dave? We're burning a lot of daylight. What did we leave out?
It was ISO, the Insurance Services Office. There's a rating number they use, and I mean things like, is your home by a fire hydrant? Can a fire engine turn around in your neighborhood? Things like that. I just think that it's important information used for rating, regardless if there's a pre-existing fire by your home.
Okay, so fair enough. But the complaint we were talking about, is that people have said the state has this new wildfire map and the insurance companies use it to decide whether or not to insure and how much it costs. That is categorically untrue. The insurance companies use own information and not the state's
information.
What's public information?
Exclusive. What's ISO, that? Your ISO number is.
I understand your point about the ISO and whether or not you're close to a fire hydrant, but you are ignoring the other point about the map, because people have come to believe that the state's wildfire hazard map is how the insurance companies decide what to insure and how much it costs. That's not true. Let's go to James in Mattawa. Hey, James, welcome to the Radio Northwest Network. What's on your mind?
A couple things, but the fire issue, I'm not in a fireplace, but I know my local area, it seems like the fire tax seems high enough. I don't know why they don't have the fire tax supplement some of these for insurance, because they always have an abundance of money and paying way too much.
Well, the fire tax is supposed to pay for fire, James. Isn't the fire tax supposed to pay for fire service to come put the fire out? Fire insurance is the people who say, if your house burns down, we have to pay for a new one. They're two different things.
I understand that. I just thinking that our fire department always has abundance of fire or money, and they
do
waste it.
And well, then maybe you should reduce the tax rate.
Total loss.
What about reducing the tax rate, James?
Yeah, we've been trying to vote that down. And then on the debate, you know, social media's been lying so much about Camilla saying that she's willing to debate and saying that Trump's not willing to debate. So I'm glad that it's finally getting spread out that Trump really does want to debate. So
well, he does, and he came out and he said, look, we've already arranged three debates, three dates, and three networks to carry it. Kamala Harris will only say yes to one. And I wonder when Americans are going to get peeved that the person who's running for president on the Democrat side of the aisle hasn't talked to a reporter on the record in 18 days. And if that's the way she behaves as a candidate, what do you suspect she's going to do if she becomes president? She'll be just as invisible as Joe.
Yeah, I think she's trying to pull the same thing as Joe did on last election, where he just kind of kept out of sight, kept out of mind, and just tried to politicize, push all of her agendas over the media, saying that she's good, where she's just about as lost as he is.
Well, and it'd be nice to see a few questions to Tim Walz as well, not just about his military record, but he's presided over a disaster. He took over a state that had $14 billion surplus. Now they have a deficit. He took over a state and crime has gone up almost 300%. Under his watch, when there were riots in Minneapolis, he refused to even activate his own National Guard, you know, that he served in for 24 years. And you wonder why that's the case. You know, this guy has a lot of questions to answer, and I kind of wonder if we're ever going to hear any answers from the Democrats. Let's go to John. Hey, John, welcome to the Radio Northwest Network. What's on your mind? John?
Since it's Thursday, I had a conspiracy theory.
Go for it.
And a few years back, I read an article that says companies like Google and Facebook could cause a 10% swing in elections. And I'm thinking it's either an act or a cultural conspiracy between Kamala Harris with an East Indian cultural background. And I believe Google's head is also East Indian with the same kind of cultural background.
Do you think one has anything to do with the other?
Well, I think it could be a cultural conspiracy of two East Indian people. And, you know, how about
a conspiracy between the Democrat Party and liberals who run most of the tech companies? Isn't that much more likely?
Well, you know, I like the cultural one, because I understand if you Google Trump, you don't get much of anything.
No,
and
you don't.
I think Occam's razor would suggest that there's something going on.
I think there is something going on, but I think it's more political than it is cultural. Let me get one more in. Chris from Richland, what's on your mind very quickly?
Okay, quick, Lawrence. this stuff about the fires and have homeowners insurance and stuff like that. Do you think that the government should have some liability in these fires, not just
yes.
put them on the homeowners?
Yes.
I understand we got to protect the forest from our house, but how about the house from the forest?
I think that's a great way to put it, Chris. That was brilliant. You got the Lars Larson Show.
The Lars.
Quiet, please.
Ladies and gentlemen.
You ready for the big show?
In exactly 15 seconds, we'll be on the air.
Lars. This is the Lars Larson Show.
With great humility, I am asking you to be excited.
Honestly provocative talk with Lars Larson.
I may be a white boy, but I'm not stupid.
Broadcasting across the Pacific Northwest and covering Oregon, Washington, and Idaho on the Radio Northwest Network.
Lars.
And now.
Then we're going to kick the Biden crime family out of the White House.
Here's your host.
My memory is so bad, I let you speak.
Lars Larson.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you, and I'm always glad to get to your phone calls and emails. It's the Radio Northwest Network on a Conspiracy Theory Thursday. And imagine this. State lawmakers who don't at all respect the Second Amendment rights of citizens. So they say, we're going to make everything we can illegal for citizens to do. And the one of the few groups that is standing in the way of that is the Oregon Firearms Federation, and its head, Kevin Sterrett, joins me now. Kevin, welcome back to the program.
Thank you, Lars.
Would you mind telling my audience, because they hear the term ghost gun, but tell them what House Bill 2005 actually outlaws and why you're going to court against it.
It outlaws the legal possession of firearms that people make themselves, essentially. So what it says is that you cannot own a gun you've made yourself unless it's had a federally approved serial number on it. And it's a very complicated situation, because if you've already made one of these guns, which is perfectly lawful and it always has been, it's extremely complicated to figure out who's supposed to affix the serial number and how this is supposed to be done, and nobody really knows. And, of course, after September 1st, it won't be legal at all, because while there's an exception in the law for certain dealers and manufacturers to take the gun in to be serialized, it is still illegal to possess it. So there's no legal way you can do it. And, of course, if you move into the state with a gun you've already made, there's no way to do it. It's not clear who's allowed to do it, what the serial number is supposed to be. It also outlaws this unicorn called undetectable firearms, which is comedy because there's nothing that's undetectable, but that's what the meth-addicted gerbils in the legislature write.
Now, let me ask you about this, because I want to put this in a historical context, because the Second Amendment is, have Americans been making their own firearms for at least a couple of hundred years?
Of course. I mean, that's, in the pioneer days, most people made their own firearms, and perfectly legal, and it's still legal federally, even though they tried to make it illegal. There's nothing, some of the best firearms ever created were created by people like John Browning, who made these things initially in their garages. So it's perfectly legal. People have been doing it, and now they've made it a crime and made it almost impossible to comply with their convoluted laws, and that's why we're suing them.
Now, the other piece to this, and tell me if I'm wrong about it, but under House Bill 2005 in Oregon, if I own a gun manufactured with a serial number and I decide to make some changes to it, oftentimes just cosmetic changes, is that legal?
Cosmetic changes to the gun? I don't think that's effective.
I guess if I said I want to put a different stock on a rifle that I own, I want a collapsible stock, I want a folding stock, I mean, things like that, would those also be affected by HB 2005, or is that a different set of rules?
No, I don't think they'd be affected by 2005. But obviously, the real issue for us, of course, is that the bill was passed by the Republicans, who showed up and gave them quorum to pass it when they could have refused to do that, and it would have cost them nothing. So after they passed the bill, they came out on the Capitol steps with a big phony check for $25,000 saying, this is going to go to the inevitable lawsuit. So I've contacted Vicki Breese Iverson, who was the person who was in charge at the time, and said, hey, we're ready. The lawsuit's begun. Send us the check. I'm feeling we probably won't hear back from them.
No, probably not, because your group ends up fronting the cost, and these fights are not cheap, are they?
No, they're incredibly expensive. Unfortunately, we're not alone in this. Thankfully, Firearms Policy Coalition has partnered with us, or we partnered with them. We're very proud of that. We're thankful for that. But the fact is this could have been done for free, except when Iverson, the Republicans, had this bill in front of them, instead of walking out when they could have at no cost to themselves, they stayed behind, passed a Democratic agenda, made a bunch of Oregonians criminals, and then lied about what they were going to do to stop it. And, you know, hopefully they'll come around and we'll get a check, or FTC will get a check. They took the money from their members. They took $1,000 from each of their members. I'd like to know where that money is now.
Yeah, it'd be nice to know, and that's one issue. The second issue is, as you point out, an awful lot of people already own these guns, but in less than a month, it's going to be illegal to be even in possession of one. How do they plan to enforce that, or do they, or is it just going to be arbitrary and capricious? If somebody happens to know you have one and tells a cop and says, hey, I think Kevin or Lars has one of these things, that they then come after you? Because that sounds like the definition of arbitrary and capricious.
Well, they could inadvertently stumble on you because they found it for some other reason, or they could do, you know, in Legion with the feds, what they've done is gotten the mailing list of companies that provided some of the unserialized parts, then make the assumption that anyone who received one of those parts actually built a gun. And you don't even have to build the gun. Just having an unfinished part, which is not a firearm in any way, without an approved serial number, which is impossible really to have done, you will be a criminal.
So how do we fix this? Is there any short-term fix for people to comply pending the lawsuit that I hope you're going to be successful with in challenging this as unconstitutional?
I don't know. You know, the law says that you have to have a serial number affixed by a federally licensed dealer, but it's not clear when that serial number is fixed to the gun, who gets listed as the manufacturer, who this is reported to, who... theoretically there's a format for creating a serial number, but when you create a serial number, then the firearm needs to be registered with the feds, or at least the manufacturers always do that. Well, who manufactured it? Is it the dealer? And what power does the dealer have to do it? He's likely not a manufacturer. So I did know one dealer who was starting to do it, now doesn't do it anymore. But I don't really know how somebody complies with this. And if they choose to just get rid of the gun in question, they still have a liability when the cops or the feds come knocking on the door and saying, we knew you bought one of these parts, and now we want to know where it is.
Oh, and by the way, just for the people who aren't as familiar with guns, Kevin, are most of the criminals out who commit crimes using guns? There is no such thing as gun violence, but there are people who do violence using a gun, just like there are people who do violence with a blunt object, a baseball bat, a hammer, or a screwdriver. They're not getting their guns by going out and manufacturing their own, are they? Kevin, we're going to get you back on that line if we possibly can, but I'll tell you what, we had a little bit of a phone problem. I'm going to start naming the phone company in about 10 seconds because I'm getting sick and tired of the phone problems. I apologize for that, folks. It does happen. But let me answer the question for Kevin, because I don't think we're going to get him back in time. If you check with the police and you say, are you finding that most criminals are owned or are armed with guns that they actually manufacture themselves? Kevin, there's a reason that lazy criminals don't go out and make their own guns, isn't there?
Well, I mean, it's pretty easy to get a gun off the street. And the fact is that most of the guns that are reported by the media, by the cartel media and law enforcement, are not guns that people have manufactured themselves, but guns that have had their serial numbers scraped off, conventional guns that came with serial numbers that people criminally removed. So, you know, you can't believe what you're being told. And the fact is that no matter where they come from, bad people are going to do bad things with guns. And the only people who are affected by this law, once again, thank you, Oregon Republicans, are good Oregonians who want to obey the law.
And I think you're right. I'll call Breeze Iverson and see if she'll come on the show and answer that charge, because I think she should. And frankly, I wonder if the police are going to start using HB 2005 and saying every time we find a gun with a scraped off serial number, we're going to charge that person for possession of a gun that doesn't have a serial number. That's Kevin Sterr with the Oregon Firearms Federation, and they are going after this. They're suing in court. Coming up in a moment, was Joe Biden's FBI actually working hard to get President Trump killed? I'll give you the latest evidence coming up, and it's not a conspiracy theory.
Hey, Jamie.
The voice of the people.
This is the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. I've got a theory, and it goes this way. Was Joe Biden's FBI trying to get President Trump killed? And if you say, well, that's an outrageous theory, I'll give you the details. The fact is that the FBI and other Homeland Security agencies allowed a man into the United States with an incredibly terrible background and then let him stay here. He is now in custody and accused of being part of a plot, not the one in Pennsylvania, but part of a plot to assassinate President Trump. I'll get into the details on that in just a moment. First, I want to go to Tom in Kent. Hey, Tom, welcome to the Lars Larson Show on this Thursday. What's on your mind?
Hey, Lars. My question is for the upcoming general election in Washington State.
Yeah.
I want to know your opinion on a lot of the semi-bird supporters. Do you think they'll turn up for Reichert in the general?
I hope they will. I can suspect some reasons they may not, because the semi-bird supporters went to the Republican convention and engineered to get the endorsement of the GOP for semi-bird, who I don't think deserved it at all. And of course, he got about 9% of the vote on the primary, so it didn't do them much good. Now, they may be angry about that and say, well, gee, you know, our guy lost. Well, guess what? In elections, lots of people lose. Should they throw their support behind Reichert? Absolutely they should. You want Bob Ferguson as the governor of Washington, but will they? I don't know. And in fact, I haven't heard from any semi-bird supporters since the election. But if I do, I'll be glad to ask them that question. Get behind the person who's going to win, or go off and sulk in the corner and say, I'm taking my vote and I'm going home. Let me get back to this plot against Donald Trump. And you say, oh, we know all about what happened in Butler County, Pennsylvania. Oh, no. But I've told you that they arrested a man. He's a Pakistani national. He was conspiring with Tehran, Iran. The folks in Iran wanted to assassinate Donald Trump. That's according to our government. And the FBI allowed this guy, Asif Raza Merchant, a guy from Pakistan, they allowed him into this country in April of this year. They gave him special permission to come into the United States because they said, we are giving you a significant public benefit parole. He was flagged on the terrorism watch list. He had recently traveled to Iran, and the government knew that, and they let him into the country anyway. They interviewed him. They fingerprinted him. They inspected the contents of his electronic devices. He had arrived at an international airport in Houston, the George Bush Intercontinental, and they let him leave with this special parole that then expired on May the 11th. And guess what? Like so many people who are allowed into the United States, there are people who come here all the time on tourist visas, and then they just overstay them. This guy was allowed into the country even though he was on the terrorism watch list, and even though the FBI's Joint Terrorism Task Force thought it was important to fingerprint him, inspect his electronic devices, and even interview him. So they had some suspicions about the guy. Today, he is under indictment. He was arrested on July the 12th. Now, let me tell you for the timeline. That's the day before the attempt on President Trump's life in Butler County, Pennsylvania. So this guy was not involved in that in any way, shape, or form that we can tell. But what the government alleges in the indictment against Asif Raza Merchant is that he had support from the Iranians to assassinate Donald Trump. And I've told you why it makes sense that Iran would try to assassinate a president or a former president or a candidate for presidents, because Iran was practically bankrupt under Donald Trump. Donald Trump had imposed sanctions on Iran. Some of their assets stayed frozen under Donald Trump, and he denied them the sale of most of the oil they want to sell. Plus, oil prices were relatively low under Donald Trump because Trump was pursuing an all of the above on energy, meaning drill, baby, drill. Get natural gas, get oil, get all forms of energy. So what changed? January of 2021, Joe Biden comes in. We can debate the election another day, but you know where I stand on it. Joe Biden takes the oath of office, and almost immediately, he unfreezes Iranian assets. That was worth billions of dollars to the Iranian government, the biggest sponsor of terrorism on planet Earth. as a country, as a state. They are the biggest state sponsor of terrorism. How do I know that? The U.S. State Department says that. The CIA says that. So when you give a lot of money or allow a lot of money to flow into the hands of people who sponsor terrorism, what's the logical next thing that's going to happen? They're going to go out and they're going to sponsor terrorism. They know in Tehran that if Donald Trump becomes president, I believe he will in January, he will reimpose the sanctions on Iran. He will forbid them from selling the oil they're selling right now at a much higher price, thanks to Joe Biden's actions in the United States. Joe Biden canceled pipelines. Joe Biden vowed to put the oil companies out of business. Joe Biden said, I'm not going to lease more land to drill for more oil and natural gas in the United States. He took all those actions that jacked up the price. And then he told the mad mullahs of Tehran, yeah, go ahead, sell oil. The sanctions are still officially on the books. He didn't wipe those out. But he told the mullahs they could go ahead and sell a lot of oil. They have taken in, the estimate today is that they have made $80 billion in the last 3.5 years. Now, like I said, when you put $80 billion plus the unfrozen assets into the hands of people who sponsor terrorism, what are they going to do? Well, we found out on October 7th when there was a slaughter in Israel funded by Iran. We found out when Houthi terrorists began staging attacks, assaults on both U.S. commercial shipping and U.S. military ships. That's one of the results. We found out when Hezbollah had a lot more money and they're engaged in terrorism. So you've got all this going on. And does the Joe Biden administration do anything? Absolutely, they do not. They want appeasement, appeasement, appeasement. I mean, if there is a Neville Chamberlain of the 21st century, it is Joseph R. Biden from Delaware. So what happens now? We find out this guy was in the FBI's hands. They could have turned him around, put him on a plane, and sent him home. They didn't do it. They knew he was on the terrorism watch list. And what do they found out? Despite direct travel to a country with known terrorist activity, the memo written by Homeland Security relays that Merchant was released without incident into the United States and free to travel to desired destinations. He said he was going to a family member's home in Texas. Did he leave when his visa was up on May the 11th? He did not. He stuck around and was arrested on July the 12th, the day before Butler County, PA. Now, consider what this is. This is a federal agency that decides to let a guy into the country who's now accused of plotting to assassinate President Trump. That's item one. Then what do we know about item two? They knew about the threat and they had deliberately, they say, the Biden administration says, we jacked up the amount of security around Donald Trump. Really? You added more security? Is that why the perimeter around Donald Trump on July the 13th, the day after this guy's arrest, was at 140 yards and that a sniper could get all the way to a roof, the roof of a building and point a rifle at Donald Trump and come this close? He hit the president's ear. He didn't kill the president only because the president happened to turn his head at the last second. So we've got the Secret Service that shortchanged Donald Trump's security, and we've got the FBI letting terrorists into the country even when they know that they're on the terrorist watch list. You're listening to the Lars Larson Show. Larson Show.
Can't fix stupid.
Stupid is forever.
But you surely can boot them out. This is the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. Well, I know that most of you probably don't know about this celebration that's going on right now. The Biden White House is celebrating the anniversary of the Inflation Reduction Act. Now, I notice they don't usually call it by that name anymore because it wasn't designed to reduce inflation at all. And the guy who knows that best is Kurt Couchman. He's a senior fellow in fiscal policy at Americans for Prosperity. Kurt, welcome back to the program.
Oh, hi, Lars. Thanks for having me back.
So now we've had 2 years since the passage of the CHIPS Act, in which we paid a lot of money to technology companies, which now seem to be cutting their staffs. Didn't exactly work out the way they thought it would. And then the Inflation Reduction Act, which I guess in Washington, D.C., you just say, what is it we want to brag about? Oh, I know, inflation, that's a problem. Just put that name on it. Even though, did this thing ever even purport to have anything to do with reducing inflation?
Not really, but I guess if you compare it to the massive blowout that they were trying to do and that the House passed before Joe Manchin held the line and got him to downsize it to this legislation, yeah, inflation is lower than it would have been if Manchin had rolled over with the rest of his party and passed that monstrosity called the Build Back Better Act. But, you know, Manchin was very concerned about inflation at that time, so Schumer, smartly, was like, hey, why don't we just name it that, and then we'll make sure that it's scored as fully offset, even though it hasn't been, and then Manchin can be okay with it, even though it's all these subsidies for all the different energy stuff out there. And by the way, the subsidies have been massively higher than the Joint Committee on Taxation and the CBO, the Congressional Budget Office, thought they would be. So it's actually increased deficits, increased federal borrowing, and thus created more inflationary pressure, not less.
Kirch, you know more about government than I do, but how is that possible when the Congress is the only entity in the federal government that can actually spend money? They have to pass they call them appropriations bills. It's a law that says the Congress says you'll spend this much money, and then they send it off, and all the president can do is sign it or not sign it, and then the money gets spent. How do they spend more money than the Congress authorized them to spend?
Yeah, that would be nice if that's the way that it actually worked. So there's appropriated spending, which is what you are describing pretty accurately. But then there's direct spending, and then there's spending through the tax code. A lot of what this bill is spending through the tax code as tax credits and other sorts of things. And by the way, they actually created tradable tax credits with this legislation. You remember how cap and trade didn't pass in 2010?
Yep.
And well, they did a version of that with this legislation. They made it possible. Let me actually read you what the final rules from Treasury said. It said, quote, the Inflation Reduction Act also allows businesses to transfer all or a portion of any of 11 clean energy credits to a third party in exchange for tax-free immediate.
Now, I'll tell you what, we're going to grab that call back in just a second. Kurt, hold on for just a moment. We had a little technical problem there. That's Kurt Couchman. He's a senior fellow in fiscal policy at Americans for Prosperity. I want to ask him about these tax credits, and I want people to understand exactly what these credits are all about, because tax credits are not tax deductions. I think all of us who filed our taxes, and I've filed mine finally for 2023, know what a tax deduction is. So, Kurt, I'm telling my audience, a tax deduction is easy to understand. You buy a house, you pay mortgage interest, and then you get to take the amount of interest you paid and deduct it from the amount of money that you earned last year, and that's a tax deduction. A credit is something different. Even if you made not a single dime, but you have a credit in your hand, it's worth whatever it's stated as. So if it's a $1,000 tax credit, even if you paid no taxes as an individual, if you have a $1,000 tax credit, you can get $1,000, and it's paid out by the federal government. This works the same way on a gigantic scale for technology companies, does it not?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, a tax credit is basically free money. It doesn't matter what your marginal income tax rate is. It's just money that you get by virtue of doing the thing that the tax credit is attached to. And I'm not sure what happened with the phone there, but they've basically financialized the green energy subsidies so that, you know, Wall Street can be trading on them, and you don't actually have to have enough of a tax liability to be able to use these green energy credits, because you can just shift them to some third party, and then they get the tax benefit, and they give you the cash in exchange. It's crazy. And I've never seen anything like this before.
Well, and the thing is, it means that a company that, say, a startup company, and some of these are startups, some of these are existing companies, could say, we're kind of short on cash. We haven't actually done the thing we're supposed to be incentivized to do, but we have all these tax credits that have been granted because of what we plan to do, so we can sell the credits to somebody else, usually at some kind of discount. So they run around, I guess, to other people in the technology business, or maybe even investors, say, hey, I've got $1,000 credit or $1 million credit. I'll sell it to you for $900,000 or something less than the full value of it. And of course, the people who buy them are happy to buy them. You're getting $1 million tax credit from the government in exchange for some amount that's less than that. Have I misstated how that works?
No, that's absolutely right. And the Tax Foundation has estimated where the benefits go. And the vast majority is to upper middle income households, people that don't need tax breaks. You know, we're doing all right. It's just another instance of upward redistribution, which this part of the Democratic Party claims to be against, but then they keep doing it with this, with the student loan bailouts, and on and on.
And does anybody check to say we've put a million or a billion or whatever amount they put into incentivizing something? Do they ever actually go out and measure what did we actually get for that million or billion?
I mean, if you mean in terms of reducing the temperature growth of the planet, I haven't seen them put that out there.
Well, I mean, let's say you go to a company and say, we want you to build more semiconductor plants. And the company said, well, we were going to do it anyway. And I suspect that's the case in most cases. You go to Intel and say, hey, build a new research in an R&D center in Ohio. And they say, well, we were going to do it anyway, but now that you're going to give us some money for doing it, we'll do the same thing we were going to do, but thanks for the tax credits. They then go cash in the tax credits. Is there any way of actually measuring you gave the money to make something happen? Did that thing happen, and did it happen bigger than it would have without the tax credit? Or is this just a giant giveaway?
Well, it's kind of a little from column A and a little from column B. There are people who have gone and looked at it, and yeah, the industries where the subsidies are flowing, they've found that there's more of that activity, but it's coming out of other sectors of the economy. You've got people, you've got plant and equipment. They would be doing something else, but now they're going here because that's where they're chasing the money to. There's not a net increase in investment and productivity from this stuff. There is an increase in the sectors that are being subsidized, but that's actually a loss to the overall economy because people are being pulled away from things that actually match consumer demands better that they would otherwise be doing.
Yeah, because a private company would say, we're thinking of building a new plant. How big a plant should we build? Even if the tax credit caused them to build a little bit bigger plant than they would have anyway, they were going to do that activity anyway. So they say, okay, thanks for the extra cash. We were going to do that anyway, but we appreciate the taxpayers giving us more money. But there's really no way to show that the tax credit actually did the public any good if that's what you wanted to do, incentivize the creation of a bigger chip factory or a bigger R&D factory.
That's right. And remember, this is all at the front end. This is like the companies, oftentimes you do have to do something before, but then, you know, you check back a couple of years later and you see that some of these companies have gone out of business that wasn't sustainable. They took the money and kind of cashed it out, essentially. Or there'll be companies that get huge and then just implode. You might remember Solyndra. I guess 15 years ago. Total boondoggle. And we're starting to see some of that in this space as well. Some of these chip factories that were supposed to be built ended up being much smaller and hiring far fewer people than the press releases and the groundbreaking, you know, ceremonies seem to indicate they would.
That's right. That's Kurt Couchman. Kurt, thanks very much. He's Senior Fellow in Fiscal Policy at Americans for Prosperity. When I get back, I'll get to your phone calls and emails at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-527.
Senator John Kennedy gets it.
Mr. President, you just got to try harder not to suck.
Well said, Mr. Kennedy. We agree. This is the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. This segment of the show is brought to you by NickShivers.com for an instant offer to sell your home immediately. No showings, no hassles. You pick the closing date. NickShivers.com for details. So, what's happened in the last several hours? Our ex-poll question kind of sums it up. Should America see three presidential debates between President Donald Trump and Vice President Kamala Harris, or the one debate that Kamala Harris has actually agreed to do? She's agreed to do the debate on September the 10th. Trump has said, look, we've already negotiated with three different TV networks to air three debates, one on September 4th, one on the 10th, and I think the third one is on the 25th with ABC. So it's going to be Fox, NBC, and ABC. Kamala Harris will only agree to one debate. Donald Trump would like to have three. Should America see all three or just one? Today's Expo at Lars Larson Show and at LarsLarson.com is brought to you by Ultimate Truck Services. If you rely on trucks for business, Ultimate keeps your biggest assets on the road and running right. Find them at UltimateTruckService.com. Let's go to Jeff, listening on the Radio Northwest Network. Hey, Jeff, welcome to the program. What's on your mind?
Oh, hi, Lars. I've been listening to you for a long time.
Thank you.
Sorry. I think you should only have just the one, but I was wondering if they knew the questions before they stepped on the debate stage.
It depends on who you believe, because the TV networks will all tell you, cross their heart and hope to die, that the people on the stage do not get the questions ahead of time. Now, we know that Hillary Clinton back in the day and the DNC managed to get a hold of some of the questions in her debate with Bernie Sanders. Bernie Sanders had, I don't like Bernie Sanders' positions on the issues. I got nothing against him personally, except that he claims to be a socialist and he owns three houses, lots of cars, and he has a fat bank account, which kind of belies the idea that he's a socialist. He wants everybody's money shared with everybody else except his. But having said that, did he deserve a fair and square shot at the nomination? The answer is yes. Did the Democrat Party want him as their nominee? They looked at him and said, we're going to put a socialist up as the Democrat candidate. That's going to be a disaster. So they deliberately torpedoed his campaign to make sure that he couldn't win. They did much the same with Joe Biden, because Joe Biden had three other people running for the nomination. And Joe Biden lost his first three primaries in this year. And then all of a sudden in March, his other three opponents just mysteriously disappeared from view. And if you suspect the fix was in, I suspect it too. It's what Victor Davis Hanson calls coup after coup after coup. There was a coup to put Hillary Clinton as the nominee. There was a coup to put Joe Biden in as the nominee. And there was a coup when they showed up at Joe's house and said, you either get out of the race for reelection or we're going to haul you kicking and screaming out of the Oval Office using the 25th Amendment to the Constitution. So the Democrat Party runs through coups. It is not democratic at all. So what do you think of that?
Well, my thought is if Donald Trump, if Mr. Trump would have the questions that they're going to ask, you know, he don't have to say a word. All he has to do is let her answer the question and then turn around and say, well, let's see, you said this and hit a button back when you were, you know, either a senator or a vice president. Now, which is it? Are you lying then? Or are you lying now?
Oh, I realize how it could go, but think about this, Jeff. Unlike, say, Hillary Clinton, I will never say that Hillary Clinton is not conniving and smart. She is. She's just an evil personality. But Kamala Harris is as dumb as a bag of hammers, and that's kind of an insult to a bag of hammers. I think if you gave Kamala Harris all the questions a week ahead of time, she'd still be lost on the debate stage. I mean, anytime see her, she was asked about inflation the other day, and you'd think somebody who's in that position would say, I know I'm going to get asked about inflation. I'll be asked about Ukraine. I'll be asked about the Middle East. I'll be asked about energy. I'll be asked about illegal aliens in the border. I should probably think of some answers to those questions ahead of time, or at least be familiar with the topic. She is clearly lost in space every time. Even if she knew the questions a month ahead of time, I don't think it helped her. Trump, on the other hand, stood there today and took questions for an hour or more, and had absolutely no problem providing solid answers to those questions. And that's what the Democrats are afraid of. She's going to show up on the debate stage, whether it's one debate or three, and she's going to flop probably just as differently, but just as badly as Joe.
Well, I'm just saying, because, you know, I know my wife said if he comes out and just straight up attacks her in front of a national audience on television, all the women, especially women of color, are going to turn around and go, yeah, no.
But you know what I mean? I know exactly what you mean, and probably there are some women who will react that way. There may be some men who react that way and say, I don't like the way he treats women. But if you noticed, President Trump's style has changed just a bit. I mean, even on the stage with Joe Biden, he could have laid down a blistering attack on Joe Biden. He stood back and let Joe Biden fall on his face all by himself. I don't think Donald Trump is going to be dumb about this one. I think he's going to let Kamala Harris absolutely go out and screw herself up by not answering questions, because he can see what she's doing right now. And if he has any advisors, they're probably saying, just let her talk. Everybody in America is going to say, that woman can't be president. You got the Lars Larson Show.
The Lars Larson Show.
You ready for the big show?
In exactly 15 seconds, we'll be on the air.
Lars. This is the Lars Larson Show.
With great humility, I am asking you to be excited.
Honestly provocative talk with Lars Larson.
I may be a white boy, but I'm not stupid.
Broadcasting across the Pacific Northwest and covering Oregon, Washington, and Idaho on the Radio Northwest Network.
Lars.
And now.
And then we're going to kick the Biden crime family out of the White House.
Here's your host.
My memory is so bad, I let you speak.
Lars Larson.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you, and I'm always glad to get to your phone calls and emails at 866-8-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk at LarsLarson.com. And, of course, it is Conspiracy Theory Thursday, and there is plenty to go around right now, like the conspiracy to try to cover up what's going on with Kamala Harris's new running mate. And, in fact, the stolen valor that Tim Walz, governor of Minnesota and now vice presidential running mate of Kamala Harris, seems to have engaged in. And believe me, this is going to be a Donnybrook, because on the left, they're trying to come up with every excuse they can possibly raise to say, well, he didn't exactly lie. Well, yeah, he did exactly lie. He ran for Congress and claimed to be a retired command sergeant major in the military. From his duties that he undertook as a member of the National Guard in Minnesota. Except he wasn't a retired command sergeant major. And if you say, well, it's just a difference of opinion about rank. Try telling that to anybody who served in the military. I haven't. But when you talk to veterans and you say, does it matter whether you're a corporal or a lance corporal? Does it matter whether you're a master sergeant or a gunnery sergeant? Yeah, it matters a lot. And does it matter when Tim Walz tried to run around saying, why, I've served in war, and you can't let Americans have the kind of weapons of war that I carried into battle? Except that when he was deployed or ordered deployed, he quit the National Guard. And there are a number of his fellow service members who've said, look, this guy ran out on us. He, quote, bailed out on us. And I almost wonder, let me just suggest this. Kamala Harris's presidential campaign is already so problematic, you almost can't believe it. You've got Kamala Harris running for president. No voters involved in that choice. And then she chooses somebody with these kinds of problems, not just a radical left-wing record as governor, not just a failed record as governor of Wisconsin, but the flips and the flops he's done. This is a guy who used to have an A rating from the NRA. Now he has an F rating. And what do you think that says to everybody, that he flips and flops on issues? And the things he is in favor of that we know for a fact, he believes in the gender mutilation of children. He believes in driver's licenses and college tuition for illegal aliens. I mean, you just go right down the list of all the things we know about him, because these are the positions he's taken. He's not a great candidate. And I kind of wonder whether or not the Kamala Harris campaign might just see fit, even though we've only got about 90 days till the election, just over that, might say, you know, we're going to have to ditch this guy because he's not working out. Except they know they almost can't afford to do that, because people are going to say, when do the voters in the Democrat Party get to have any say in who the candidates are? On that note, let's talk about Tuesday's primary and Jared Sessler, who's a veteran entrepreneur, former NASCAR driver. He's been on the show before, and you've heard his voice before. He's running to replace Representative Dan Newhouse in Washington's 4th Congressional District. Jared, welcome back to the program.
Thanks, Lars. Happy to be here.
Glad to have you there. And tell me this, what do you think of Tuesday's result?
Well, we were very satisfied. We, believe it or not, and I actually have documented evidence of this, we shared the what we thought the results were going to be with the Trump team a couple of days before the election, and we were within 1%. So, we, you know, we had good data. We had a very strong team. We had a strong following. You know, the people of Central Washington are ready for change. And, you know, I just happened to be blessed to be in this position and standing up for our great country and having a lot of support behind me. So I'm confident about November and looking forward to just getting through this next 3 months, which is not going to be easy.
Well, you've had the support of Donald Trump and Dan Newhouse, who was one of those, correct me if I'm wrong, who voted to impeach then-President Donald Trump back in 2021. That's a good result, and that's why the voters said we're giving Jared Sessler 30% and Newhouse only gets 25%, right?
Yeah, well, it was interesting because, you know, Dan Newhouse worked much harder than he has in the last few cycles, and he spent a lot of money, but you didn't see his base moving much. It's pretty much the same folks that voted for him last cycle who maybe are anti-Trump or, you know, they have some, you know, affinity towards his seniority that really isn't legitimate or something like that. But they stuck with him. And I think that's the case. And I think it's really a bad omen for him as he looks forward, because he really doesn't, it doesn't matter how much money he spends, there isn't more votes out there for him.
All right, what are the issues you're going to use to be the signature issues? Because I've always thought that when you're running for office, I know that candidates want to talk about 50 different things, but for the voters, you probably need a half dozen at most that are the signature issues you're going to present to them, saying, if you choose me, these are the things that should matter to you. What are they?
Well, I don't think, Lars, it's really anything magical for me. I mean, to me, I'm just a regular guy, you know, raised my kids, homeschooled them, married for almost 30 years. And I'm only doing this because I'm so disgusted with what's happening with our country. And I think that same attitude resonates with the voters and with the population, because they're also disgusted with what's going on. And so there are some things that are important to me, nothing much more important at this point than helping President Trump get our economy back in order and making sure that we can feel safe again. You know, I think with the situation with the southern border and just the tension internationally, with potential wars looming and things like that, I think people in America, you know, Central Washington included, just don't feel as safe as they once did. And I think,
nope.
You know, those are some of the core fundamental issues are the big things that we have to address.
I mean, this is why I think, Jared, that the Democrat Party has already decided Trump's going to win, Kamala's going to lose, and that's the end of it. They won't say it out loud, although some of them come very close to saying it out loud, because they realize the woman who was the border czar, who presided over this disaster, Trump has said it may be as many as 15 to 20 million people who came into our country illegally in just over 3 years. How in the world does she get on a debate stage on September 10th, just over a month from now, and explain that in any way that makes sense?
Yeah, I don't think there is any way. I don't know that I necessarily agree with you. I think if the Democrat Party was serious about this election, I think they would have put somebody legitimate in that seat instead of Kamala Harris. I don't think that she has the capabilities of winning. I think what it is it's a sign that, you know, they're using big tech and they plan to steal this election, or at least attempt to steal this election again. And I think it's something that we ought to be very concerned about.
No, I think and we don't necessarily disagree. I'm saying that how does Kamala Harris sell the position that it's okay to have a wide open border and she was in charge of it? And I don't see that she wins votes that way. I mean, there may be people out there who believe that illegal aliens should just be able to come into our country, and they're going to let her do it. But, Jared, I appreciate what you've done. I appreciate your success. Congratulations on Tuesday's result. That's Jared Sessler, who's running to replace Dan Newhouse in Washington's 4th Congressional District. In a moment, I'll get to your phone calls and emails. And if you want proof that foreign citizens are currently contaminating America's voter rolls as we head up to an election, I'm going to give it to you from one state in particular. You're listening to the Lars Larson Show.
Jamie Markley.
in control.
Our Constitution is a document in which we, the people, tell the government what it is allowed to do.
This is the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. I want to tell you about some evidence that's just emerged, and it comes out of the state of Virginia, the Commonwealth of Virginia. I've heard over the years people say, well, there's no truth to the idea that non-citizens are voting in our election. And if I ask people, how do you know that non-citizens are not voting? They say, because it's against the law. Now, I got to tell you something. I laugh in the face of people who say that. I say shooting heroin is against the law. Taking fentanyl or trafficking fentanyl is against the law. There are lots of things against the law that people still do. There's some brand new evidence out of Virginia that at least thousands of non-citizens have been voting in our elections. I'll get into the details on that. First, though, I've kind of neglected callers. So let me go first to Tracy. Hey, Tracy, welcome to the Lars Larson Show. What's on your mind?
Yeah, hi. So mine's kind of a conspiracy. So the day you were talking about...
Tracy, can I ask you, are you on a speaker phone by any chance?
Oh, sorry. Yep, I am. I forgot.
Okay, the producers tell you not to do that for a very good reason. Because it sounds like you're on an Elon Musk rocket to Mars. But having said that, you now sound lovely now. What were you saying so people can hear it?
So when I was, when you were talking about Jamie Raskin's plan, if Trump wins, you know, that he what he was going to do.
Yep.
I think it was with the 14th, right. And then I think it was that same day I heard the VP pick, and I just thought, what? I mean, it just seems so weird. Everything to them is about race, so I thought kind of weird that they picked this quote-unquote
old white,
white guy.
Yep.
Yeah, and it just didn't make sense. And, of course, I was when I think of all the BLM stuff, I think more of Fry, the mayor. I kind of forgot about the governor's role and all that. You know, I didn't really know who he was, but... Anyway,
by the way, Fry, the mayor of Minneapolis, is the guy who was begging Tim Walz to send the National Guard when Minneapolis was on fire. And Tim Walz is the guy who, even though he served in the National Guard, said, I'm not sending the National Guard, and then disparaged them as a bunch of 19-year-olds who know how to cook.
Wow. Yeah, I was thinking Fry was just letting it happen. No, that's right.
No, Fry was begging Walz to, I mean, the same way any big city mayor would go to the governor and say, Governor, this is beyond the capability of our police, which we've defunded, unfortunately. Would you please send some help? And Walz said no.
Right, right. Yeah, so my thoughts were that it just makes so absolutely no sense at all that their whole plan is they figure, or my quote-unquote conspiracy, is that they figure they're going to lose anyway, and let's, in other words, they want to, they know they're going to lose, so they can do their plan of what Jamie Raskin wants to do and see if they get away with it, because they get away with everything.
Well, and so people know what you're referring to. Joel might even have the soundbite handy of Jamie Raskin, because Raskin is one of those evil left-wingers. But he's already assuming, based on this, on what he said the other day, that Donald Trump is going to win. You say, okay, Donald Trump's going to win. He'll be president. And Jamie Raskin says no. And do we have that sound by Joel? Because, okay, let's play it right now.
So it's going to be up to us on January 6, 2025, to tell the rampaging Trump mobs that he's disqualified. And then we need bodyguards for everybody in civil war conditions.
Now, Tracy, people will say, no, he's assuming Trump's going to lose in the rampaging mob. No, if Trump loses, you don't have to disqualify him. It's only if Trump wins that you have to disqualify him. And why is Jamie Raskin already assuming we're going to have to disqualify this guy? What, 2 months after the election? You're going to, because the election is November 5. And he's talking about January 6th, and he was nice enough to be explicit and say January 6th, 2025, so nobody can say, well, he was talking about the J6 2021 mess. And no, he's talking about this coming January 5 or 6, it's going to be our job to disqualify Donald Trump. Well, if Trump loses the election 2 months before, you don't have to disqualify him. But they're going to do that, and the argument, do you understand what Section 3 of the 14th Amendment says?
A little bit.
Okay, what it said, I mean, they wrote it after the Civil War, and they said, we need to say that anybody who actually fought as a combatant, you know, a general or a private, in the Civil War against the North can't run for office. Now, they couldn't disqualify everybody, say everybody who lives south of the Mason-Dixon line can't run for office, because right. that's crazy. They just said, if you were in the military or you were part of the leadership of the Confederacy, you can't run for office. Now, what did Donald Trump do to get him get himself lumped in with a bunch of Confederates? And the answer is, he didn't do anything, except, I'll tell you, if you have any, do you have any liberal friends, Tracy?
I do, yes.
We all do.
Yeah.
We all do. So when they say to you,
I don't understand them.
Well, no, but you got to just set them straight. They're like confused children. You know, my granddaughter likes to take my checkbook and write $1 million checks. And I can guarantee you there ain't $1 million in that account, but she writes $1 million checks. And you say, honey, you can't cash that check. In fact, I kidded her. We went to the grocery store the other day. I said, we don't have any money. You wrote $1 million check in my account. It's now overdrawn by about $999,000. But explain it to them like children. Say, listen, here's what's going on. You know, the Democrats are in a panic. They have Joe Biden. He's still a problem. Kamala Harris, she's not exactly, you know, anything to write home about. Now they got walls and he's got problems up one side and down the other. Just explain to them what's going on. But then they create, when they don't have problems or don't have enough of them, do you know why they didn't pick Josh Shapiro from Pennsylvania? Because he would be a natural pick for most political campaigns. Do you know why they didn't?
Well, did it have something to do with it being Jewish?
He's a Jew. And they said, we're not picking the Jew. And why?
Right.
Because they're trying to make this extreme end of their party, like the crazy aunt you keep in the attic. They're trying to say to the crazy end of the party, hey, we won't do anything to offend the Hamas terrorists, your friends over in the Middle East that are trying to slaughter innocent people. So we won't pick the Jew. And I think the Democrats are going to spend the next 20 years trying to explain that, because ordinarily, presidential campaigns and say, we need Pennsylvania. If you can get a good, solid liberal Democrat who's in a prominent position in a major state like Pennsylvania, we're going to pick him. And they say, no, we're going to pick the old white guy from Minnesota.
Yeah.
You know, and you say, you did what? No, just try to explain it to them. Understand they're all going to be confused about this. Tracy, I very much appreciate the call. Let me give you the short version of what's going on in Virginia. They have a decent governor in Glenn Youngkin. And what he said was, I want to make sure we have a solid election. So they have the Department of Elections, called Elect, has removed 6,300 non-citizens from the voter rolls since Youngkin took office. 6,300 people. Now, remember, the margin in the battleground states in the last presidential election was said to be between 11 and 12,000, that Georgia was just over 11,000. You have 6,000 non-citizens voting. I don't even know if they vote Republican or Democrat. It doesn't matter. You have thousands of invalid people casting ballots. Just between January of 22 and July of 24, just over 2 years, the state of Virginia, Commonwealth of Virginia, removed more than 6,000 non-citizens, because Virginia was one of only three states that said, if you're going to register to vote, you have to give us your full Social Security number. And they didn't have one because they're not citizens. And if they didn't have a Social Security number, that means they're not green card holders either. Glad to be with you and always glad to get your calls. 866-HEY-LARS. You've got the Lars Larson Show and the Radio Northwest Network.
The Lars Larson Show. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show, and it's a great program. If you want to join the conversation, it's 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. You can always vote in our poll on X. The poll on X today is about presidential debates. Donald Trump has negotiated for three of them. Three networks have said yes. Kamala Harris, the vice president and now presidential candidate without any voters being involved, well, she's agreed to one. So should America see three presidential debates, as Donald Trump has negotiated and proposed with the networks, and they've all signed off, ABC, NBC, and Fox News, or should we just have one? Because I think Kamala Harris knows she's not going to do very well in one. But That's the question. You can find it at Lars Larson Show on X, also on our website at LarsLarson.com. I want to talk about regulation, and I know that it's a topic that can sometimes make people's eyes glaze over, but people should understand regulation right now costs Americans trillions of dollars, and the GDP is cost trillions of dollars because of that. So Patrick McLaughlin joins me now, who's a senior research fellow and director of policy analytics at the Mercatus Center. Patrick, welcome back.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be on again.
I want to ask you about the regulations, not only at the federal level, but also at the state level, because that's what you took a look at. Which states are the best and which are the worst for regulations? Can you give us an idea, say a snapshot of what it looks like right now?
Yeah, I can. And let me give a little bit more background before I get into the specific states and where they are. You know,
sure.
As you know, and probably a lot of your listeners know, what I am concerned about is just the buildup of regulations over time. It's not necessarily one or the next regulation. It's the totality of them. So this regulatory accumulation. And I've been able to, you know, by studying how much regulation there is at the federal level and now at the state level, we've been able to understand what does that do to the economy. And, you know, you referenced the cost of the economy from federal regulations earlier, but this is also true at the state level. More regulation tends to be associated with higher poverty rates. It destroys jobs. And it's inflationary, right? The consumer prices that we, you know, are worried about every day now, a lot of the reason they're going up over time is there's more and more regulation causing things to be more expensive. So with that background, let me get into some of the latest results that we have from looking across the states. We have this huge data project. We have to go collect all the regulations in all the states, either all, you know, state-level regulations, and see how many they have. And now we can compare the states as of 2023 and see who's at the top, who's at the bottom. You know, whether those are winners or losers, I'll leave up to the listeners. But at the top, we have kind of the states you would suspect. California is number one, New York's number two, New Jersey and Illinois. It is surprising that Texas is fifth.
Wow.
However, Texas has, in all the years we've done this, Texas has been one of the highest ranking states in terms of total amount of regulation. And then at the other side, we have Idaho is the least regulated state for the second year in a row, and probably more than that, depending on how you want to look at it. South Dakota and North Dakota, Montana and Alaska are the other ones that are in the bottom five in terms of how much regulation there is.
Is there any way to analyze whether, because I know the first thing I do when I talk about getting rid of regulations, people assume they're saying, oh, you're going to have no building codes and you're going to have sewage and drinking water and, you know, puppies and kittens living together and all kinds of horrible things happen if you get rid of regulations. I'm not saying get rid of all of it, but could we trim it down a bit? Is there any evidence that say people in Idaho suffer because they don't have a pile of regulations like California does?
There is not evidence that they suffer, but there is evidence that their economy gets a lot better as you cut regulation. So I'll tell a story on that one. British
Sure.
Columbia. So I live in Washington State. So I happen to border Idaho. We also border British Columbia. And you can compare those states in the level of regulation. Compare, you know, Washington to Idaho. Washington has about 201,000 regulatory restrictions on the books right now. It's the eighth most regulated state. And by the way, a restriction that's like, it's basically a prohibition. You may not do this, or it's an obligation. You must do that. So we're counting those up within regulations. So Washington, 201,000. Idaho, about 31,500 on the books right now.
Wow, that's a huge difference.
So, yeah, six times, right? Six times more regulation in Washington. And you can drive across the border and you don't suddenly enter into a war zone or some sort of like environmentally contaminated area. Safety is the same. So all these outcomes that we're trying to achieve with regulations, they don't appear to be different in Idaho versus Washington. But, you know, that's anecdotal. We've studied this in detail. We've looked at British Columbia. You know, in British Columbia, it's not some, you know, right-leaning state like Idaho. It's something more like Washington in terms of politics. But they, about 20 years ago, decided they needed to cut red tape. They had too much regulation on the books. Their economy was suffering. And they put together this fairly experimental effort to get rid of regulations that were unnecessary. And going back to your earlier point, they're looking at the stuff, can we cut stuff that's not creating benefits, stuff that's not protecting the environment, stuff that's not creating safety? And they did that. They cut about 40% of their regulations in a three-year period.
Wow.
And as a result, their economy, yeah, it's incredible. 40%,
it must have felt incredible for citizens to say, you mean I don't need a license for that anymore, or I don't have to, you know, jump through all these hoops anymore? It must have been amazing.
Yeah, it's precisely that kind of thing. You know, there was a regulation, for example, limiting how big of a TV screen you could have in a restaurant. So sports bars didn't really exist prior to that. So stuff like that's on the books for whatever reason from, you know, the 60s or something like that. And no one was in charge of looking back to say, can we get rid of these things? Until finally they did say, okay, we're going to put the regulatory agencies themselves in charge of it and obligate them to find red tape to cut. And let me make this other point here. You know, the economy did a lot better post cutting those regulations. Economic growth rate improved by over one percentage point because of cutting that 40% of regulations, cutting away all that red tape.
Can you imagine if you could take, what are we at, $25 trillion a year in GDP nationally? Add 1% to that, that's a pile of money, isn't it?
Yeah, and you take it down to the household level, it's something like $35,000 to $40,000 per household that we'd be talking about gaining.
So how can we go about doing, I would almost think that, you know, the ham-handed approach that I would start with would be to say, why don't we take Idaho's list and break it up into the areas where, well, I'm sure there are regs on trucking and regs on commerce and everything else, and then take a look at what's in all these other states and say, is there any reason we need all this stuff? And could we go back to sort of more like an Idaho model and maybe even have Idaho take a look at theirs and say, you got 30,000, could you get by with just 25,000 rules instead of 30,000, and everybody would get better?
Well, Idaho's certainly trying to continue cutting where they can. They've gotten to the point in Idaho where a lot of the regulations they still have are regulations are obligated to have because of federal laws. So there is some point where the state can't do anymore, and Idaho is probably approaching that. But I love your idea. I mean, if we did see some sorts of outcomes in Idaho that no one liked, then of course Idaho would put regulations back on the books, or more likely the federal regulators would step in and say, you know, we're going to have some regulations apply to you if the states won't do it.
Yeah.
You don't really see that happening. So what's the logic for, you know, Washington State, where I live, gold plating, right? Putting all these additional regulations on top of the federal regs?
It makes no sense at all. That's Patrick McLaughlin. He's at the Mercatus Center at George Mason University as a director of policy analytics. And you can see policy analytics turns into profit and usually opportunity. Back in a moment. You've got the Lars Larson Show and the Radio Northwest Network.
Lots of folks worry about their firearms, but Lars doesn't have to worry about Biden taking his guns. He stores them upstairs. This is the Lars Larson Show.
Big Iron Ore is here.
Welcome back to the program. It's a pleasure to be with you, and I'm glad to get to your phone calls and emails. It's a conspiracy theory Thursday, so let's consider this. Kamala Harris, we are told at this point, has not done a single interview, sit-down interview with a reporter, or appear at a news conference in 18 days. She has apparently talked for a few minutes off the record on Air Force Two, which is what the vice president flies on. And now we're told she may stay away from the press all the way to Labor Day. And is America going to tolerate a presidential candidate who has a lot of things to answer for, and all candidates have something to answer for, who just says, I'm not going to sit down and talk to reporters. I'm not going to take questions. She is followed around by a pack of reporters at all these campaign events she goes to, and she's willing to speak at the events because then she's in charge of the message, but she does not want to take questions. And I'll tell you, my personal theory is, every time you see her ask questions, even by relatively friendly reporters or questioners, she comes up with some new cockamamie point of view. And the second question, the X poll today, since Donald Trump today announced that he has negotiated three presidential debate dates, the 4th of September, the 10th of September, and the 25th of September, does America, or should America, expect to see three presidential debates as Donald Trump has proposed and negotiated, or the one that Kamala Harris has agreed to? You'll find the X poll at Lars Larson Show and at LarsLarson.com, and brought to you by Ultimate Truck Services. If you rely on trucks for business, Ultimate keeps your biggest assets on the road and running right. Find them at UltimateTruckService.com. We were just talking about regulations, so let me go first to Larry. Hey, Larry, welcome to the program. What's on your mind? And Larry isn't listening, so he loses his opportunity. Let's go to Dale instead. Dale, welcome to the Lars Larson Show. What's on your mind?
Hey, Lars, how are you?
I'm doing well, thanks.
So I'm giving you a call from New Jersey. However, I was born and raised in Oregon. And I wanted to talk to you about the forestation and forest management.
Yeah.
It's a situation that is close and near to dear to my heart. In the 1940s, my grandparents owned a logging company, and they were awarded the contract, or one of the contracts, to log the Tillamook Burn and harvest timber that had been destroyed.
Dale, I have a feeling we're going to get a lot of background, and we're never going to get to the point. We need to kind of get to the point, and I appreciate the background.
Yeah.
There's not an unlimited amount of time, so.
Sure. With the forest fires, I understand. I 100% agree with you that forests need to be managed. But in the event there is a fire, you also need to award, the state needs to award contracts to have the timber salvaged on top of it.
And they're not doing it because the environmentalists, the people in charge in Oregon and Washington who are in the elective offices say, we don't believe in salvage logging. They should. They waste literally billions of dollars of the taxpayers' money because we own, for the most part, we own those forests. The fires seem to occur almost exclusively on public land. And when you don't harvest the burned timber, and there's a lot of good wood in there, you lose billions of dollars.
And jobs.
Yep.
Yep. Yep.
Okay. So that's what you're suggesting.
Yeah, absolutely. And it'd be not just good for the economy, but great for our force.
Yeah. It makes them healthy.
Yep.
I mean, do you think any farmer would be able to farm by just throwing a bunch of seeds and then just harvesting for the next decade and say, yeah, I'll just harvest whatever grows? Well, no. That isn't going to work.
No, it
would work out terribly, except that is kind of at the core of what the environmental tree hugger people hate the most. They hate the idea of using America's forests. They call it a plantation, where you say, well, we own this land, we have trees on it, we'd like to cut the trees and replant them. And you say, but you don't get a natural forest. Do you have anybody in your neighborhood that has a natural lawn, where they just kind of let whatever grows grow? Because there's usually one in every single neighborhood. And you say, this person doesn't care. They let whatever grows out there grows. It never gets trimmed. It never gets cut. It might not even get watered. But they just let it grow. And they love the fact that it's natural. Well, anthrax and smallpox are natural, too. I'm not a fan.
Right. They should tell that to the people in the city of Detroit that lost everything 4 years ago and see how they feel about it.
Yeah, all those towns, and Paradise, California, a few years ago, that literally a whole town burned to the ground. Some people died, people lost their homes, and they lost their community. But Dale, the bottom end of that is you've got to elect different leadership, because the people there will not do what is common sense. Now, if I said, I'm going to make a movie, okay, Dale, would you hire, if we had the choice of Joel Maha, my great producer, associate producer of the show, or George Lucas, who would you pick to make the movie?
The one who's been making movies.
Yeah, George Lucas. So, if you're going to pick, if you have government that has a terrible track record of managing forests, and they lose in Oregon, Washington, about 1 million acres a year on a low year and millions of acres on a bad year. Do you pick them or Weyerhaeuser or any of the other private companies that manage land without losing millions of acres of trees?
Right. You just coined the phrase from Trump, you're fired, and replace them.
Yep, that's exactly what you got to do. Dale, thanks for the call. You're listening to the Lars Larson Show and the Radio Northwest Network.
The Lars Larson